Chapter 4, one of the difficulties of Hebrews that we've mentioned is that the book of Hebrews is kind of unique in the Bible in that it's a sermon, and so we're preaching sermons about a sermon, and so that makes it a little bit unique in this, and we've been very conscious of just the pacing through Hebrews, of not wanting to get too far into the weeds, but also not wanting to miss out on all the important things that God has for us in Hebrews. And the writer of Hebrews starts out just right out of the gate of the book, letting us know that God has spoken to us now through His Son, who He doesn't name quite yet. He'll name the Son today, but in Hebrews chapter 1, He just says God has spoken to us in many ways over time, but now He's spoken to us through His Son, and we would do well to pay attention to what God has spoken to us through His Son. And then He goes on to make an argument that the Son is better than the angels, and you'll notice on our graphic, it says Jesus the better ... because as we go through Hebrews, the writer is going to show us how Jesus is better than the things that we think are already pretty good. And so there's a noticeable shift today in the writer's argument. He gets away from angels and he gets into the high priest. And we don't resonate really with the high priest because that's not something that we have as a part of our culture. So we're going to unpack today the duties of the high priest and look at why Jesus is the better high priest. Leading up to this, Pastor Brent's passage from last week, three times is mentioned in the previous passage that if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts. And so again, this call to pay attention to what Jesus has said, what God has spoken through His Son. I've said this many times before, if Jesus were just a good man that died a tragic death, that's a terrible story. But if that's all the story is, we don't have to pay much attention to what He said. It doesn't matter all that much. But if Jesus really did conquer death, if He did really defeat sin, if He did walk out of the grave, then according to Tim Keller, everything that He says matters and is of infinite importance. And again, we would do well to pay attention to it. And so as we pick up in chapter 4, verse 14, the writer says, "Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast to our confession." We'll pause there for a moment. So if you're like me, you read this, and some questions kind of immediately come to mind. Okay, what is a high priest, right? Because again, we don't really have high priests in our culture here in America. So we have to ask the question, what is the high priest? Why is a high priest significant? Why is Jesus the great high priest? And then what is the confession to which we are able to hold fast, or to which we must hold fast? And so just to do a little bit of historical work here, what is the significance of the high priest? The role of the Old Testament high priest was one of a mediator and one of an intercessor. The high priest acted as the mediator or the intercessor between God and the people. It was a unique privilege to be a high priest. Not just anybody could be a high priest. You had to have a certain family lineage to occupy the role of the high priest. And in the temple that they had back then, there was only a certain part of the temple that the high priest was the only person that could go into this part of the temple, the Holy of Holies. And the high priest would go in once a year on the day known as Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. He would go in to perform the rituals of atonement, not only for the sins of the people, the sins of the nation, but for his own sins as well, because the high priest, because he was from among the people, was himself a broken and flawed sinner. And when the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, nobody could enter the Holy of Holies. And there was this kind of always looming thought of, like, what if he dies when he's in there doing his rituals? Whether of natural causes, or what if, God were to strike him down, what do we do? And so they would tie a rope around his foot. And when he would go in there, if he died, they could pull him out so nobody would still have to go into the Holy of Holies, because that was reserved for the high priest. The high priest was a head of the priesthood. He led the officiating priests, was a descendant of Aaron. That was the family lineage that he had to come from. Aaron, of course, was the first high priest appointed by God. And so at the end of the day, the high priest, his whole job was to mediate between God and the people. And there were processes designated for how that mediation were to go. So the writer of Hebrews says, since then we have a great high priest, we ask the question, well, why? Why is Jesus the great high priest? And the writer of Hebrews gives us a glimpse. He says, because he passed through the heavens. So in other words, Jesus, and incidentally, this is the first time the writer of Hebrews has named Jesus, is right here. He's referred to him as the Son up to this point in the book. And so he names the Son as being Jesus. And he tells us that Jesus is our great high priest, and he is the one who has passed through the heavens. And so that's unique, because the high priests of the people, it can't be said of them that they passed through the heavens. They passed through the earth. Jesus passed through the heavens, and this is likely a reference not just to the divinity of Jesus, but probably a reference to the ascension of Jesus, right? He went into the grave, and they didn't have to tie a rope around his foot to drag him out of the grave. He walked out of the grave on his own. And he was seen by a great number of people in his resurrected state, and his disciples witnessed him ascending into heaven. This is probably what the writer of Hebrews is referencing, is that Jesus passed through the heavens, or he ascended to heaven, and he was witnessed to have ascended into heaven. These things can't be said of a human high priest or an earthly high priest. He ascended to heaven, and the Bible tells us that he sits now at the right hand of the Father, and he makes intercession for us. He knows all. He sees all. All things are under his rule and his reign and his authority. And he makes intercession for us. So that's why Jesus can be known as the great high priest. The high priest mediates between God and man. Jesus, who has passed through the heavens, mediates for us now into perpetuity. And so what is the confession to which we must hold fast? And I find this an interesting thought. So we're told just to hold fast to our confession. And as I thought about this, I thought about what is it that we do confess about Jesus. And we have, you know, our church documents that tell us here's who we believe Jesus is, our statement of faith. It's posted on our website. You can read it. But that's not what everybody confesses about Jesus. I just read a thing the other day that Elon Musk is supportive of the teachings of Jesus. And he would confess that the teachings of Jesus are good for society, and that they're right, and that they're moral. But to my knowledge, I don't know that he confesses Jesus as God. And that matters of how we confess Jesus. Do you confess Jesus simply as a historical person? We have so much evidence that Jesus was a real person, that he walked the earth, that he lived. We have a record in our Bibles of the things that Jesus taught, and I think very few people would argue the things that Jesus taught are not good for society. It's good for society to be about the things that Jesus was about. But is your confession of who Jesus is simply historical, practical, or is your confession of Jesus that he is God in the flesh? Right, the Bible tells us that God became flesh and he dwelt among us. He lived among us. And we've seen his glory. And we saw his life. It's recorded for us. His disciples witnessed him, as I mentioned, ascend into heaven. If he really did walk out of the grave, if he really did ascend to heaven, if he really does sit at the right hand of the Father making intercession for us now, that matters. that matters greatly. And that's the confession that the writer of Hebrews is telling us that we must hold to. This is the message that the writer of Hebrews has told us over 4.5 chapters now that we would do well to pay attention to. If your confession of Jesus is simply that he was a good man that taught good things, that's not enough. Our confession of Jesus is not just that he was a good man that taught good things, but that he was God in the flesh who dwelt among us, and that we have seen his glory. And we're told in Romans 10:9 that if you confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, that you'll be saved. And what Paul is talking about in Romans is not simply just uttering the words that Jesus Christ is Lord. There's a lot of people that might even utter those words, but may not necessarily believe in the resurrection power that brought Jesus out of the grave. Because again, if Jesus didn't come out of the grave, the Apostle Paul tells us in Corinthians that the resurrection, it's the crux of Christianity. If Jesus didn't raise from the dead, then we don't have anything. We've bought into a sham if Jesus didn't raise from the dead. But he tells us here in Romans that part of our confession is believing that he did raise from the dead, because there's only been one person in human history that has done that. And as advanced as we are technologically as human beings, we have not cracked the code of life and death. We just haven't. And so the significance of the high priest is that he is the mediator and the intercessor. Jesus is the great one because he has mediated in a way that the earthly high priest could not mediate. We'll get to that more in a moment, which makes him the great high priest, or the ultimate high priest, the high priest of high priests. And the confession to which we hold fast is that Jesus isn't just human, but that he's divine and that he's God in the flesh. And it's that confession that ultimately will lead to your salvation and my salvation. In verse 15 of Hebrews 4, the writer goes on to say that we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. And these are all things that are fostering the argument that Jesus is the great high priest. He says that he's not unable to sympathize, or he can sympathize with our weaknesses. He's not unable to do that. We see recorded for us in the gospel accounts Jesus' humanity. We see he was hungry. We see that he got frustrated. We see that he got angry. We see that he got tired. We see these things. And so on a human level, he is able to sympathize with our weaknesses. What the writer of Hebrews is not saying here is that Jesus had weakness, right? Jesus was God in the flesh, but he stepped into human flesh and he lived the human experience and experienced the things that you and I experienced. He experienced temptation. We have that recorded for us in the gospel narratives, that he was tempted by the devil. Yet, in these experiences of weakness and these experiences of temptation, Jesus was without sin. You and I, it can't be said of us that we're without sin in these things. We sin in our weakness. We sin in our temptation, right? But Jesus was without sin in those things. And so again, fostering the argument that he is the great high priest. And so verse 16 says, with all of that in mind, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace in our time of need. What a great just single verse this is, that we're told not to be afraid of God. Right? The Bible talks about the fear of God, right? And I'm not going to get into that today, but we're not told to cower in fear over God. And I think about Adam and Eve when they were in the garden, right? When they sinned, they did the one thing that God told them not to do. And do you know what it is that they did? They went and they hid. They hid. And the Bible tells us that in a moment they realized that they were naked and they were ashamed of their nakedness. They hid. And then the Bible tells us that God was walking in the garden and he called out to him and he said, "Where are you?" And I love it in the Bible, when God asks questions, it's not because he's looking for an answer, right? God, this is God being gracious and merciful to his children who just blew it. And it wasn't a like, "Where are you?" front and center now. It wasn't that kind of a "Where are you?" It was God graciously calling to his children, "Draw near to me. Draw near to me." And when they made themselves known, do you know what God did? He didn't say, "Hey, you're naked and you should be ashamed." He didn't say, "You blew it." He didn't say, "Way to go." But my kids growing up always heard me say in these moments, "What's the lesson that we learned here?" And they hated it. God's not asking what's the lesson that we learned here. He was drawing his children to him. And the writer of Hebrews is telling us that when we fail in our weakness, when we give in to temptation, we don't have to go hide in our shame, but that we can draw near to him with confidence, not draw near to him with trepidation, but that we can draw near to him with confidence. And he refers to the throne not as the throne of authority or the throne of power, though it is that, but he says that we can draw near to the throne of grace. And the Bible defines grace simply as God's unmerited favor towards us. We can draw near to the throne of grace, and as we draw near to the throne of grace, that we would receive mercy. And mercy, the Bible would define, is God withholding just punishment that we deserve, that we rightfully have earned. And that in drawing near to the throne of grace and in receiving mercy, that we will find help in our time of need. And again, this just further makes the argument of why Jesus is the great high priest. The earthly high priest not only atoned for the sins of the people, but he had to atone for his own sins. Jesus was sinless, and he fully atoned for the sins of all of the people once for all. This Yom Kippur, this was an annual thing that the high priest had to do. Jesus, once and done, atoning for all of the sins of the people. And then as we enter into chapter 5, the writer goes on to talk more about the high priest. And he says, "For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins." This was the role of the high priest. The high priest was chosen from among men as an affirmation of an appointment by God into that role, so that their life would be dedicated to offering gifts and sacrifices for sins. And this is hard for us to wrap our minds around, because we don't live in a culture that does what they did back then. But if you think about a culture who, just ancient culture, like they had to grow and raise their own food, I mean, that's just a lot of work in and of itself, right? We have it pretty good today where we don't have to grow and raise all of our own food. If you want to, you can, but you don't have to. And so when they would have to make a sacrifice for sins, they would have to take one of their own animals, which was their livelihood and their sustenance. So there was a cost to it involved in atoning for sins that the people had to bear. And not only the cost, but there's a lot of work. I didn't grow up on a farm or a ranch or anything, so I've never butchered an animal. But it's a lot of work to do that. And you would have to do this on the regular because you sinned on the regular. And so it was this constant cycle of sin and atone for sin. The Bible establishes early on that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. And it was this wash, rinse, repeat kind of cycle where you're constantly absorbing the cost of your sin by pulling an animal from your stock, It's sacrificing that animal to atone for your sins. Jesus did a once-for-all sacrifice for all the sins of humanity, past, present, and future. That's a hard thing for us to wrap our minds around as well. Verse 2 of Hebrews 5 says that the high priest can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. And again, the writer of Hebrews is making the argument that the earthly high priest isn't a once-and-done kind of a thing. The earthly high priest can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward because he himself has his own ignorance and his own propensity to be wayward. He's set with weakness. And so this earthly sacrificial system is imperfect. It doesn't quite get the job done the way that the job needs to be done. In verse 3, the writer goes on to say that because of this, because of the weakness that's beset to the high priest, he's obligated to offer sacrifices for his own sins as he does for the people. So again, we're reminded that the earthly high priest is imperfect. The earthly high priest, as good of a high priest as they might be, as hard as they might work, they're imperfect to do the job that needs to be done. Verse 4, no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. And so, while we're told that the high priest was chosen from among men and was appointed to act on behalf of the people, that this was established by God. When I read this, I think of Jesus in the garden, and we'll get to this more in a minute, but Jesus has this difficult thing, the hardest of hard things before him in going to the cross. And he goes and he prays to his Father, if there's any other way, tell me now. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. And so Jesus submitted to the will of his Father. And Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews will tell us in a little later in the book that for the joy that was set before him, he endured the shame of the cross. Verse 5 says that, so also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but he was appointed by him who said to him, you are my son, today I've begotten you. That's a reference to Psalm 2. And as he says in another place, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. That's a reference from Psalm 110. Paul talks about in Romans that at the appointed time, at the right time, that Christ died for the ungodly. And so this has been the plan, right, all along. And there was a time when the Father said to the Son, it's time. It's time for you to go step into human flesh. It's time for you to go dwell among those who are going to take your life. It's time for you to go subject yourself to suffering among the people that you created. And so Christ did not exalt himself to this role, but he submitted to the will of the Father. And the writer of Hebrews mentions that he's a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. And we're not going to get into Melchizedek today because that's going to come up here in a couple of chapters. So I'm just going to whet your appetite today and more to come on this later. But Melchizedek was a priest king in the Old Testament, and he's a bit of a mysterious character that we don't know a whole lot about. But he was a priest king, and so he is at least a foreshadowing of Jesus. It's possible that he's more than a foreshadow, and whichever one of us gets into Hebrews 7 on that one, we'll unpack that more when that comes. But he's referenced here that Jesus is a priest in the order of the priest king of the Old Testament. And so that tells us something about who Jesus is. That he's a priest king. Verse 7, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. And I think this is a reference to Jesus in the garden. I just want to read from you from Matthew chapter 26, starting in verse 36. It says that Jesus went with them, referring to his disciples, to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And talking with him, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and he prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and he found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak." And again, for the second time, he went away and he prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And so leaving them again, he went away and he prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. And he came to the disciples and he said to them, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand when the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise and let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Another one of the gospel narratives tells us that this was such an intense moment that Jesus actually sweat drops of blood. We all understand intense moments, but I don't think we understand these kind of intense moments where it would cause you to have blood seeping out of your pores. That this was the intensity with which Jesus prayed to the Father. And he prayed repeatedly because he knew what was before him. And what I find particularly fascinating, he acknowledges that he's about to be betrayed. And what would you and I do? What would you do if you knew that you were going to be betrayed? You'd probably just bail on the situation if you knew a betrayal was coming. You'd do whatever you can to avoid being betrayed. You would do whatever you could to avoid difficulty because that's what we do. But Jesus tells his disciples, "You can sleep later," kind of like you can sleep when you're dead, you know, kind of a comment here. And he says, "My betrayer's at hand. We got to get going." And it wasn't going the other way. We got to go towards it, is what Jesus is saying here. We got to go towards the betrayal. We got to go towards the difficulty. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the shame of the cross. And he willingly walked towards it after asking his Father if there was any other way repeatedly, but submitting ultimately to the will of his Father. And so when the writer of Hebrews tells us that Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears, this is what he was talking about. Have you ever prayed with loud cries and tears? Some of you probably have. You know, at least to some extent, what it's like just to cry out to God in desperation. In difficult moments. Maybe not even fully understanding the difficulty that you're in. Maybe your loud cries and your groans are just asking why. Jesus wasn't asking why. He knew why. And he walked towards it. He walked towards the difficulty. Going on in verse 8 of Hebrews 5, it says, "Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered." What the writer of Hebrews is not saying here is that Jesus lacked in his understanding of obedience. He didn't lack in his understanding of obedience. What the writer of Hebrews is saying here is that Jesus showed us the pattern of obedience. And maybe another way he says, we learned obedience from him. He learned us obedience because he showed us what it was like to submit to the most difficult of things, to say, "Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." And so he showed us the perfect pattern of obedience. Jesus' life as a whole was the perfect pattern of obedience. You and I, we don't go very long in our obedience. Especially if you, like, you might think about, "Well, I thought this thing, but I didn't do it." Well, you don't get a lot of credit for that because you still thought it, right? The Bible tells us that even kind of thinking the things that you shouldn't do, that's bad too, right? And so if you were to get into my head for about an hour, you would think weird things about me, because I think a lot of things that I ought not think, right? We all do that. Jesus showed us a life, 33 years of a pattern of perfect obedience, culminating in the cross, culminating in his obedience to the hardest thing and submitting to the will of the Father. Verse 9 says that being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. And again, the writer of Hebrews isn't saying that Jesus lacked in perfection. The writer of Hebrews is not telling us that because Jesus did this thing, he leveled up. It's not that. He's saying that Jesus completed something that needed to be completed. And the thing that needed to be completed, that he was the source of our eternal salvation. Eternity is forever. I've said this before, we can't fathom eternity, because we're finite beings. We have a beginning and an end. Infinity, no beginning, no end. It's forever, both forwards and backwards. That's the part that blows our mind. Like, we can think of eternity as like from this point forward, but eternity is also from this point backwards, right? We can't fathom it. And Jesus completed the work required to become our eternal source of salvation. And that source is available to all who obey him, to all who obey the one who showed us the perfect pattern of obedience. And because of this, verse 10 tells us that Jesus is designated by God as the high priest, and again, after the order of Melchizedek, after the priest king, the mysterious priest king of the Old Testament. And so hopefully we've answered questions today of what is the high priest, why does the high priest matter, why is Jesus the better one? And all of this is the confession to which we must hold fast. And in a broader sense, the word that the writer of Hebrews is telling us that we must pay closer attention to it. We must not deny it. I borrowed from a commentary from a guy named Raymond Brown, 6 essential qualities, he says, that are required of God's Son in order for him to become our great high priest. And the 6 qualities are this. While the earthly high priest was appointed by the people, Jesus was appointed by God. While the earthly high priest identified with men and women as he was sensitive to human need, he had his own weakness. Jesus, while he identified with us, he had no weakness. While the earthly high priest atoned for the sins of the people, he also had his own sins for which he must atone. Jesus was without sin and was completely victorious over it. Jesus was perfectly obedient to the divine purpose. The earthly high priest was only obedient until he wasn't. If the earthly high priest unexpectedly died while making an atonement, he had to be pulled out by a rope, but Jesus was willing to die to effect our deliverance and walked out of the grave by his own power. And Jesus' final qualification was that he was of his victorious exaltation to the right hand of the Father when he was crowned with glory and honor. This is a glorious thing that Jesus, our great high priest, has done for us. He's done for us the things that we could and would never do for ourselves. Brown goes on to say that this is what our writer means when he says that once perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation. The obedient Son saves those who respond to his redeeming message with obedient hearts and minds. Completely qualified, he is designated, clearly named by God to all of humanity as the high priest of our completely adequate and eternally relevant salvation. And so as we bring this to a close today, the question kind of comes back to this confession. Is your confession a historical Jesus, a human Jesus, or is your confession a divine Jesus? Because if your confession is simply a human Jesus, that's not going to do much for you. But if your confession is a Jesus who is both human and divine, fully man and fully God, that lived a perfect life of obedience to his Father, was tempted but without sin, was weakness and was without sin, lived the life that you were incapable of living, lived a life of perfection. And not only that, but went to the cross, joyfully went to the cross to die for the sins that you have racked up, not only you, but everybody here and all humans, both past, present, and future, for all of time, throughout history. And he died taking on the just punishment for those sins, took on the wrath of the Father, and settled the account once for all, the sins for all of mankind, then that makes him our more than adequate, completely and more than adequate, and eternally relevant salvation. And so do you believe that today? Do you believe that today? If Jesus really did these things, then it matters. You might sit here and think, well, none of that's true. You have to take that wrestle up with God. But if you're here this morning and you believe that's true, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, the Bible says that's the requirement of salvation. So we would love to talk with you after service if you're wrestling with these things or you have questions with these things. But the question does come down to one of belief. Right? Do you accept Jesus as your high priest, your mediator between God and mankind, God and humanity? Because we can't mediate that relationship. Only Christ can do that. And so I would invite you to consider that in your wrestle with things and to consider just maybe Jesus is who the Bible claims him to be. Father, this morning we're thankful. Thankful that you lived the life that we couldn't live. Thankful that you died the death that we rightfully deserve. Thankful that you made a once-for-all atonement for our sins. Thankful that your throne is one of grace and one of mercy, one to which we can draw near without trepidation, but that we can boldly and confidently draw near, expecting that as we hold fast to our confession that you will treat with kindness those whom you love. And so I pray that we would all remember that in our time of need, that you are compassionate, that you are merciful, that you are exactly who the Bible says that you are. And so please help it not to be lost on us today that you are, among other things, our great high priest who mediates, who intercedes on our behalf continually. Please help us remember that and to take joy in it. And we ask in Christ's name, amen.
All right, let's all stand and sing these last two songs together.